So what we're going to look at for the rest of tonight is what we call the man of concupiscence, is the term that John Paul II uses, or historical man. And that is the state of humankind after the fall. How did things change after the first sin? Okay. And so he's commenting on Matthew 5, 27 to 28, where Jesus teaches something that's quite radical and difficult, where he says that even if a man looks upon a woman with lust, he has committed adultery against her. Okay? And just a little side comment, you know, when Jesus is preaching the Sermon on the Mount, he's doing a couple of things. He's commenting on the commandments of the Old Testament and trying to locate the origin of those commandments within the human heart. That it's not sufficient to simply obey the commandments in an outward and external way, but we're actually called to a deeper conversion of heart, and that our actions really proceed from the heart. And secondly, he uses hyperbole to make his point. So he doesn't literally mean that you are involved in what we would legally describe as an act of adultery if you look lustingly on another person. But what he's saying is that you're doing the same, you're violating a person in the same way as you would be by committing an act of adultery. Okay, when you look upon another person in this lustful manner. Okay, so John Paul II does an extensive unpacking of that very short saying of Jesus, which packs a punch. It's a hard saying, and so we have to wrestle with, well, what does it really mean? I'm going to return now to John Paul II's commentary on Matthew 5. So he talks, you know, from the moment of original sin. Okay, so original sin is kind of a mystery. It seems to involve the sin of pride, which is one way to define that is an excessive reliance on oneself. Okay, an exaggerated sense of what one is capable of doing. And in the case of Adam and Eve, they obviously believed that they could discern truth from falsehood when the serpent spoke to them. And of course, they were deceived. And so they realized that they didn't know what they thought they knew. He was more crafty and clever than they were. And they also coveted a tree, you know, symbolically, a tree that God had forbidden from them. Okay. So they were grasping at something, again, rather than receiving what God had given to them as a gift. The devil calls into question God's credibility, and they begin to distrust God. And so then they covet what was forbidden to them. Now, this is a kind of analogy because we experience this in our lives all the time. We can lose our own innocence because we have more trust in our own judgment about things, only later to discover that what we thought was A is really B. Okay, we can be deceived. We can deceive ourselves. We can be deceived by others. We can be deceived by the devil. So when we experience and kind of relive the reality of that original sin in our lives through our own personal sin, okay, we begin to experience shame. Okay, and shame's a very fascinating concept in and of itself, which we don't have time to go into all of it. But I do want to talk about sexual shame in the context of John Paul II's commentary. Okay, so their eyes are open and suddenly they realize that they are naked. The reality of realizing that you're naked is really the experience of realizing that despite all of your overtures of confidence, you suddenly discover in the lie that you're vulnerable and susceptible to injury. And in the experience of that, we become ashamed of ourselves. Okay? And we want to, of course, cover ourselves up. That's a way of describing how we want to protect ourselves because we no longer trust. Okay, so in the sexual realm, sexual shame enters into the human story. Okay, and this is what Genesis 3 is trying to describe for us. Okay, so John Paul II explains how in seeing one another, they realized that they were naked. Okay, and so they experienced shame. And the way he describes this is he says that they begin to look upon one another in a reductive way. They begin to see one another as objects. And this look casts doubt on the gift. So you remember last time we talked about how in original innocence and unity, they looked upon one another and they saw in the other a gift from the hand of the Creator addressed to them in and through their bodies. The man for the woman for the man. What changes is that now they're looking upon their bodiliness, their bodily differences, with an impure heart. And this is what's consequent to the eating of the fruit. So the coming to the knowledge of good and evil is their sort of awakening and realization of the reality of their sin. And that experience changes how they look upon each other. They both look upon each other with distrust on the one hand, but that's because they're looking upon one another in this reducing way by objectifying one another in and through their sexuality. Okay, so that's John Paul's trying to explain. This is what Genesis 3 is talking about when it talks about the eyes being opened and the experience of their nakedness. They suddenly know that they're vulnerable and susceptible to a look which is not a look of love. It's not a look of receiving the other's gift, but rather casting doubt on the gift. And what happens as a result of this is there is a lost sense of dignity that comes with that experience. It's not that we lose our dignity, it's that we lose the sense of our dignity. We lose track or sense of our value as a gift. Okay, and this is the experience of shame. If you think about shame, it's always, shame is built on lies about ourselves. And those lies tend to be in the form of I am statements. And they're I am statements that are usually very self-loathing and very contemptuous towards the self. Like, I'm not lovable, I'm ugly, I'm a terrible person, you know, I'm not lovable, etc. Okay, that's shame. Shame is not something that God puts on us, it's something that we experience naturally as a consequence of sin. Okay, it's the devil's work, you could say. And then what results from the lost sense of giftedness and dignity is the sexes begin to relate to each other with some degree of opposition. There's a kind of opposition. And this is expressed in the curse that falls upon them in their relationship to each other. The Lord says that the woman's desire will be for her man, but he will lord it over her. Okay, and John Paul II talks about this as the insatiability of the desire. So what plays out in the history of humankind is a dysfunctional dynamic between men and women, particularly husbands and wives, but you see it in the workplace too, where men have a tendency to want to dominate and women have a tendency to want to please even the men that abuse them. And it's a kind of moral pathology. But the silver lining in that is that John Paul II explains that the insatiability of the desire means that even though we experience this fallen and broken and wounded nature, this desire for communion and connection and the exchange of love in the spousal meaning of the body remains as a foundational desire of our hearts. And we know this in our own experience, because even when our marriage is going south or our intimacy kind of sucks for a season of life, it's hard to quit. it's hard to give up altogether. And it's very tragic when people do. People try to make it work because there's something we aspire to. And that what we aspire to is the communion of love. Okay? So that's what John Paul II calls the insatiability of the desire. There's just a, it's wired into our hearts that we are, the human vocation is the vocation to love. Love is realized through the gift of self, and through the gift of self, this great exchange of persons in and through our bodies, we attain to a communion of persons, which we call marriage. So what happens as a consequence of this opposition is that modesty comes into the human story. The need to guard and protect ourselves, both externally, but also internally. So shame is a tender place. So we put a fortress around our shaming parts and our shaming places, and we cover our bodies. We try to safeguard the inner self by covering our outer self. And that works both ways. Okay, I'm going to use kind of a cringy example, but you'll get the point. You know, think back to junior high, your first dance. And, you know, maybe this isn't a universal experience, but, you know, guys are nervous with that first dance because they're terrified that something might change in their bodies. And the last thing a guy wants to have happen is for the girl to figure that out. And the last thing that the girl wants is to figure that out. It's a very awkward situation, which is why the teachers would walk around with the rulers and try to keep people further apart from each other. That's a fundamental experience of modesty. We don't want what's going on the inside to become visible on the outside when it comes to our sexuality. That's our most fundamental instinct. Modesty is something that if children are loved properly, they will actually learn very easily on their own without a lot of instruction. They'll get to a certain age and they will start covering themselves. Okay. So now I want to contrast that with people who say project themselves into the world as a sexual object through over-sexualizing themselves or being immodest. The reality there is you're dealing with a person who has probably been reduced by other people and objectified, and therefore see their value only in terms of their sex appeal. And so on the outside, they project themselves as a sexual object because they want positive affirmation and validation, but on the inside, they're likely to be filled with a lot of shame and self-loathing and self-contempt and don't trust anybody because they don't know if anybody actually loves them for who they are. And this is epidemic in our society, and it's not just women. I mean, you go onto social media and there are so many men whose whole livelihood is body sculpting and showing how they can have the perfect six pack and the perfect pecs, and you know, and they obsess with their body image. They have the same problem. They were probably fairly attractive and they got a lot of positive attention about their looks. They got a lot of free passes. But underneath that is a psychosis because they don't trust that anybody really loves them for who they are. So they hyper-exaggerate the value that other people have reflected back into them, which is not a right way to treat people, right? It's actually not good to over-affirm a person because they happen to be really attractive. That can be very harmful to social relationships because, again, it's just a form of reductionism. We're not actually affirming the person. We're saying you have social status because you have the right shape, you have the right form, you have the right face, you have the right features, etc. Okay? That's an objectification. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, so if we move then from the experience of original shame into the ongoing problem of the wounded heart, I've already touched on a couple of these points, but underneath the wounded heart is usually some experience of self-loathing. Yeah, like I can share with you my own experience. When I was growing up, I was very small and young looking. I'm still small and I'm still pretty young looking, I have to admit, but I like it more now than I did then. You know, my dad just died a couple months ago at 95, and he looked like he was 80. So, you know, I'm looking forward to that. But when I was younger, I was picked on and made fun of a lot. And I was talked down to, even when I was like 25, people, I looked like I was 12. Like literally, that's not an exaggeration. So people would talk down to me like I was a kid when I really wasn't a kid anymore. And, you know, in sports, I got pushed around a lot and I had a small complex. But I developed in those growing years a lot of self-loathing. I'm small. I'm not attractive. I'm young looking for my age. Like, there were all sorts of lies that I embraced in my life as a consequence of the kind of teasing and criticism and bullying and different things that I experienced. It's very real. And the proximate vicinity of that reality was my body. It's hard not to be self-conscious because you can't not show up in any social scene without yourself, without your body. It was a constant reminder. Like if you're struggling with your weight, you know, wherever you go, you're showing up in that manner, right? You know, have you ever, just something as trivial as you ever had to go and show up in a public place and you had a huge zit on your face? You know, it's like the North Star shining out. And, you know, it's like, it's silly that we should even be self-conscious about something so stupid, but we are. And that's because we know that people look at that critically. And you might even catch someone looking at you, like they're looking at your eyes and then they're looking at your cheek, you know, and you're like, yes, I got a big zit on my face. I'm 45 years old. I'm going through puberty, I guess, again, or whatever. But the point is, I'm making fun of this, but it's hard to not have an experience of self-loathing that is not in some way connected with our bodies. And then as we get older, we age and we become self-conscious about that because we don't, you know, we can't snap into the form that we had when we were 20-something or, you know, so it's a universal human experience that we struggle in our hearts. So when I say that the proximate reality of shame is our body, the deepest reality of shame is in the heart. It has to do with the set of propositions or lies that we hold to about our fundamental value. Because we have so many experiences in the world of people not loving us and receiving us and seeing us as a gift. And of course, on the bright side, when we do meet people that treat us in that way, it's like a heaven-sent blessing. You know, I remember in my peak years in seventh grade when I was at my lowest, I remember I was just going through a really rough time and I was pretty good at sports, but I had Oshkosh sliders in my knees and my knees weren't working, so I couldn't play sports. And I was really depressed because that's all I had going for me. You know, I was always last to be picked for football on the playground. And I often scored most of the touchdowns because I was quick. But nobody cared. I always got picked last because I was the shortest. Drove me crazy. But I had to have crutches for a time. And I was really in a bad space. And I remember I was out in the drinking fountain in the hallway during class, seventh grade. And my teacher came out to me. She came out, she put her arm on my shoulder, and she says, "Are you okay? What's the matter?" And so I kind of opened up to her and told her about what I was going through. But the people who see us, we say today, you know, who hear us and see the totality of who we are the people that we trust. It's the people that we can entrust ourselves to, that we feel confident around, the people that we can be vulnerable with. That's a glimmer and a glimpse of that preternatural life that we're meant to have. That heavenly life that we'll all have, God willing, when we get to heaven. If we get to heaven, it'll definitely be like that. So the second point I want to make is that as a result of the wounded heart, we experience a lot of fragmentation and disintegration of ourself. And John Paul II talks about the loss of freedom. Okay? When we disintegrate on the inside, we lose our freedom. And we find ourselves conflicted on the inside. Paul talks about this in his letter to the Romans. There's a law that he has in his mind, and it's at war with the law of his members. He knows the good that he ought to do, but he can't do it because there's another law at work, the law of concupiscence. Okay? So we can experience a loss of freedom. We can experience a loss of trust and an incapacity to be vulnerable. And of course, if you don't have the freedom of self-mastery, if you don't have the capacity to trust another person, and you can't be vulnerable, then you can't experience the communion of love. That's the tragedy of it. Okay? So again, staying within the realm of the sexual. This is what John Paul II is trying to help us understand, that this is why lust is a form of adultery. Because what we do when we lust after another person is we shatter the reality that God dreams and imagines for the communion of love between a man and a woman. And of course, outwardly, when people commit adultery, it's a pulling apart of what is actually meant to be joined together. Okay, and I'm not trying to judge anybody. I'm just saying that that's the reality of what happens. And usually adultery happens because there's been a disintegration of the relationship for a while before that happens. People don't naturally want to do that, but people can fall into those pitfalls when their relationship disintegrates and is fragmented and they lose a sense of their dignity. They're in opposition with each other. They're not safeguarding one another's dignity and interior life, their hearts. There's a lack of intimacy, a lack of trust. And then what happens is people go and try to find connection and communion somewhere else. But it's really a reflection of the pulling apart of things that are meant to be joined together, if that makes sense. All right, so I want to kind of wrap up here. Just I need a few more minutes, but and then we'll go into some small group discussion. But John Paul II then, towards the end of this, talks about the redemption of the body. So how does God redeem us from this mess that sin has made? And again, just sticking with the relationship between man and woman in the context of marriage. So the first thing he talks about is the need for eros to be ordered to what he calls ethos. And one of the primary ways that we redeem the relationship between man and woman is by directing our desires towards the good, the true, and the beautiful in the other person. So it's not that we are Puritans and we try to suppress our sexual desires and our erotic, even our fantasies. It's that we have to direct that energy toward the good of the other by offering ourselves as a gift to the other person in service of their life. So I always like to joke, you know, when I'm vacuuming, you know, the living room and my wife is like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm making passionate love to you. You know, it's like lovemaking has to comprise the totality of life. It's not just what happens in the bedroom. What happens in the bedroom should express the totality of the love that's given in that relationship. So when we direct that sexual energy, even when it's fallen, we purify it by ordering it towards the good of the other person in the form of self-offering and self-gift and self-sacrifice. Okay. Secondly, we have to, through growth and virtue, particularly the virtue of temperance, we have to learn self-mastery. Okay, self-mastery. And self-mastery is the formula for self-mastery. We have to have self-knowledge. We have to know ourselves. We have to know our strengths and our weaknesses. But particularly in this case, we need to know our weaknesses. And then we have to possess ourselves. Right? That is, we have to have command. Our will has to be ordered by reason so that what we choose is good. So when we have self-knowledge and self-possession, we can make a gift of ourselves. Okay. So one way to measure that, of course, is the fruits of the Spirit. Go into Paul's letters and look at what the fruits of the Spirit are. If in our relationship, husband and wife, we experience the fruits of the Spirit in our relationship, that's a very good sign. Now, a very anecdotal way, you know, very simple way to understand this is how we react when we don't get our way in our relationship, right? If we get triggered because we feel a loss of control, rather than listening to the other person, receiving the other person, trying to understand and empathize with where the other person is coming from, right? Then we're probably operating out of shame and disintegration. Okay, but if we don't get our way, and we can say, well, help me understand where you're coming from. Tell me more about what you're feeling and what you're thinking about. that's a good sign that you're really looking at the other person, not as someone who's just simply going to meet all your needs, but as another person who is addressed to you as a gift from your Heavenly Father. Okay. Now, John Paul II distinguishes between the works of the flesh, and he's commenting on Paul here, versus purity as life in the Spirit. So he just simply states that, you know, we have fleshly desires, and those aren't necessarily evil in and of themselves. But when Paul is talking about the works of the flesh, he's talking about selfishness. Whereas when we have purity, that means when we have right and upright intentions towards the other person, we really desire their good for their sake. We're living our lives in the Spirit. So again, we can think back on our relationships and think of that was a totally selfish response, or this was a generous response. We know the difference between when we're living out of the flesh versus when we're living out of the Spirit. And of course, as married couples, we want to live out of the Spirit. Okay. So last point, John Paul II speaks about true freedom as a kind of self-determination. We can direct ourselves to the good as opposed to being a slave to our passions. Last comment. I just want to address a little bit about marital intimacy. I mean, all of this is relevant to having an intimate relationship with your spouse. We have to learn how to relate and interact with each other through the logic of the gift. We have to learn gratitude. We have to learn to see the whole person. We have to learn to receive the other person as a gift. So we first and foremost need to work on the purity of our hearts, the uprightness and rectitude of our intention towards our spouse. Do we truly see them as a friend? Or do we react as though my happiness depends entirely upon you doing everything I need you to do and want you to do? Secondly, we have to learn to be vulnerable with each other. Part of the redemption of the body is reclaiming the capacity for vulnerability. But vulnerability requires two really important things. One is trust. We have to be able to trust the other. And we'll only trust another person if we can feel and sense that their intentions towards us are true and honest and upright. And secondly, we build trust by being really generous with each other. I remember, and I'll end with this story. About 10 years ago, my wife and I were going through a rough time. You know, I don't think our marriage was in danger, but we were just having a hard time. We were arguing a lot, and it was a lot of tension in the home. And I was praying at God a lot about the things I wanted him to change in her. And these were legitimate things that probably needed to change in her. But the way I was praying was I was making demands of God to fix her so that I would be happier. And I remember this at this moment I was praying about this because I was frustrated and I was praying to the Lord. And the Lord said to me very clearly in my heart, he said, I didn't ask you to change her. I asked you to love her. And so I was very convicted by that. And so I started praying differently for her. I started praying like, Lord, you know, bless her, show your face to her, let her know how deep your love is for her, let her know your mercy, help me be an instrument of your love in her life. This became my litany of prayers every day. Well, months later, all of a sudden, we'd sit down, we'd have a cup of coffee, and she'd say, you know, I was praying this morning, and I really realized that I really have to work on this part of myself. And I'm like thinking to myself, you know, I was saying that to you for about 5 years, right? And I'd go to my prayer and I'd say, Lord, I see how it works. You know, you have an access to our hearts that I don't have. But the lesson is like, well, no, you are my instrument in her life. I want to bless her through you, but you were only thinking of yourself. And so as soon as your heart changed towards her, and your prayer changed towards me, I was able to use you to help her. Because your ego got out of the way, your selfishness got out of the way, and I was able to use you as the instrument that you're meant to be in her life. Okay? So that was a major conversion for me in the sacrament of holy matrimony.